call Senate has to order 134 on the 26th of April. Present are Senators Olson, Green, Wilkin, Elton, and myself, Dyson. We have several orders of business today. Two pieces of legislation of mine, SCR 28. It's a resolution having to do with technology for distance education, and SB 281, which allows collaboration among school districts, and an overview from the American Heart Association on obesity prevention. Then House Bill 258, sexual assault with persons with HIV/AIDS, HB 393, insurance for colorectal screening. I suspect we'll get to all of them today. And I would hope that we could move the first two items out of here. We've had some discussion on them before. Wes?
For the record, Wes Keller for Senator Dyson. I will repeat what you've already seen. This is just the sponsor just asking you to pass this resolution out, and I want to go through the resolves that are on here. The first one is encourages responsible application of education technology. Secondly, encourages the virtual groupings of students. If you remember, we had this slide up that showed how many 118 schools, I believe, that are less than 50 students, and there you have a large number of basically one-room schools, and education technology allows groupings according to skills, grade level, age, that kind of thing, easier. The AYP challenges that are facing us, if you remember, is supplemental education services, easier to distance education, easier to deliver, parental choice, restructuring challenges that are ahead of us on some of our failing schools. We went over this all the last time. Encourages paying for educational technology by way of reallocations of savings from use of efficiencies of scales that get are there because of, for example, the teacher-student ratio can go up as we get in bigger groups of students, and that same amount of funding can be used for giving the teacher the tools to do the job more efficiently. And the last resolve is that just that this resolution gets passed out to all the school board members in the state of Alaska. So it just all it is just the encouragement for this kind of educational technology to get applied in the state. So with that, unless there's questions, I won't say any more about SCR 28. And I would ask that you can use version F, which is a blank CS. And the only difference between F and the other one is that last resolve to make sure all school board members, local school board members, get it.
Right. I'll move the F version, did you say?
F Foxtrot, yes.
F, the F Foxtrot version and object. Is there any objection to the adoption of the F version? Seeing none. So I don't expect this piece will get through the legislature this year, and if it does, fine. But there are some folks out there working on these issues. And just this committee's approval of that will be a real sign for them to go forward. So any questions or discussion? Senator Elton.
Just a comment, and if as a sponsor you want to respond, that'd be great. I don't have a problem with the resolution. I think it makes sense. I did note that in the resolves, most of the resolves speak to rural issues, and I would just suggest that innovative technology applications we don't ever mention urban, but we do mention rural in many of the results. I just suggest that this is urban and rural issue.
Yeah, point well taken. And in the next piece of legislation, which really speaks to districts being able to work cooperatively, I suspect that many of the larger schools will be working cooperatively to share their technology and capacity with small schools, and the computer technology will enable that to happen, but point very well taken. The chair will entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, move to report SCR 28, pardon me, from committee with individual recommendations.
Is there objection? Seeing none, SCR 28 is moved. Mr. Keller, would you speak to us about 281?
SB 281, you've heard this once, and unlike SCR 28, SCR 28 will go directly to the floor. This one has the backdrop of Senate Finance, of which four of you sit on Senate Finance. So just if you would, it's more of a general agreement on the financial aspects, assuming they will be addressed by the department, you know, in Senate Finance when it gets there. Just want to point out that SB 281 authorizes any school district in the state to enroll kids, students statewide. But there's a big conditions here. One of them is that the educational program has to be chosen by the resident district and parents. In other words, it has to be some kind of pressure coming from the home district. There has to be a cooperative agreement between the districts specifically to provide the housing, the facility, school facility, and the supervision of the child. And in the case that there is a cooperative agreement, then it's 100% funding that the student would receive if he was housed and taught and everything in the district residence. But that there has to be, again, an agreement between the district where the student is enrolling and the district where the student comes from, a financial agreement contract by law. If there is no conditional, if there is no agreement between the districts, then it goes back to the 80% funding with nothing extra, which is just a case that already exists. That's your correspondence programs, you know. But just keep in mind that this is precisely addresses what Senator Elton pointed out, is this is for all schools. This isn't just rural, you know, and it isn't just correspondence. It has to do with all schools.
We, when we presented this bill to you, must have been a month ago. Was it, Wes?
Oh, it was been 2 weeks, maybe.
Pardon?
It's in February.
Oh. Time funds when you're in flight.
Yeah.
The question came up rightly, do we need this, and does the existing law allow this kind of cooperation between districts? And we got an interesting opinions back. Was that from the Attorney General or Department of Law?
Yes, the Attorney General. I'll skip ahead here. Here's part of that response, and Jason has copies if you don't have that with you. So we'll go ahead.
So as I read the opinion that we got back, there's nothing in the present codes that preclude this kind of cooperation between districts and so on. But because our laws about education are set up with the presupposition that each district has complete control over all the students in it, and that's kind of the presupposition under which our present statutes are set up, the Attorney General thought that there was at least a possibility, if not a significant one, of it being challenged. So what SB 281 does is make it clear under the statute that districts can enter into these cooperative agreements across district boundary lines. And certainly there are many things that we picture that can come out of this, but in districts that reach the final of the 5 years of not making adequate yearly progress, they can indeed enter into agreement with some other district to provide parental choice. They can also, if they have a small school body, student body, work cooperatively with other districts to have virtual classes on specific subjects. Might be art, might be languages. where they don't have enough students in their own school that are interested in a language, and I'd hope many of those would be Alaska's Aboriginal or First Nations languages, but it allows them to share that and conduct those same classes in many places. But as you know, many schools in our state are very interested in Mandarin, Russian, and Japanese, other languages, and so it would just allow those kind of cooperative agreements. Questions for Mr. Keller? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How does this affect some of the students that go into private schools? Are they able to go ahead and interact with these programs as well?
No, not unless they enroll in a public program. You know, it's a public, it's strictly public schools. This would allow, it would allow, what I want to say, trolling for students, that's what the districts call it, but only within, between districts and in the condition. Only, got to keep that in mind, that it's only under the condition that when there's a friendly cooperative agreement there between the two districts, you know, the home and the, and the
school. Sorry, Mr. Chairman, this has no adverse effect on private education. And the private schools are not opposing.
Senator Olson, I would say definitely not, except that I think that personally that public education would be more attractive, therefore it might be a competition with the public, private.
Yeah, but Senator Olson, I think 8 or 9 years ago, maybe my second year here, I got a bill through that's part of the law that any public school is required to take any homeschool or private school student that comes through the door and wants to be educated. And of course they get, and we structure it so that they get disproportionately from the foundation formula for that, the public school that takes the private school student. So any private school that wanted to avail themselves of this sort of thing could go, their students could enroll, you know, in the public school distance delivery, and I would think just like any other student that wanted to take advantage of what was available. And it was interesting, that debate. Some of the school districts said, oh my goodness, this is terrible. And in fact, we've tracked it, and it has been very little, if any, negative effect at all. And a number of public schools have said, hey, these kids that have come, you know, for 2 or 3 hours a day are really neat students, and it's really worked well. Some of the school districts, I remember Sitka particularly, they really have an enlightened attitude. They say to the private school and homeschoolers, you all come. Want to use our library, need some tutoring, want to take any of our classes, you know. I'm sorry, I'm editorializing, but it seems to me to be a very enlightened attitude. Any other questions or comments?
I have a question.
Senator Green.
Yeah, I heard you mention, Les, that there was a required permission of the of both school districts. And show me the line in the bill that says that.
Senator Green, through the chair, that's Section 5 of the bill. And what it does is it authorizes 100% funding, formula funding. Section 5 is page 2, line, starting at line 23 to 31.
What version are we on?
I'm sorry. Version I.
Yeah, and I hadn't adopt, we hadn't moved to adopt that yet, and that's...
I didn't have it. Okay. So what did that say?
Excuse me, what was referenced
again? It was on, it's on the Section 5 of the bill, page 2, lines 22 through 30.
Okay.
Okay, where is the one that says there's mutual agreement?
It's tied to the funding, Senator Green, through the chair. It's tied to the funding. It says that 100% funding will follow the student, and the if is,
Okay.
accept that as provided, the 400B is the, if there is enough money to go around, everybody gets cut proportionally anyway. Funding for a school district that contracts for the provision of educational services or facilities under 14, 14, 12, A3, well, that's back up to the, where it says a contract with another school district to provide educational services or facilities, so it's tied to that contract.
Okay, so there's no mutual agreement, though, that they will come in and be there. If they, if the home, or the housing, whatever it is, the resident district says no, it's just impacted by their, the amount of funding the district receives.
Senator Green, as we understand it, if the home district said no, then there would be no, I mean, this wouldn't apply. The student couldn't enroll in the course.
I think that you raise a good point. In order for 100% funding to apply here for this student, it's getting some or all of his education supplied from another district that's not geographically there. They've got to be a mutual agreement. If there isn't, a student anywhere in the state can enroll in what we used to call the Alyeska Central, and now goes by another name, what, Raven?
Raven, but
or, or any other one of the distance delivery systems. But if it's a, if it's one of the cooperative ones, and to get the 100% funding, it has to be the mutual agreement of both the district supplying the teaching and support, and the district of the student's residence. So that's what triggers the cooperative and requires the cooperative agreement. Senator Green?
Does this have, what happens to those schools and extra special schools that are in place now that serve out-of-district students? Do we have any of these that are housed in another district? I think we do, but.
Yeah, Senator Green, through the chair, the leading example, I believe, is what used to be Alyeska Central School is now organized as a charter program that is operated by the YK, I believe, and the department can correct me if I'm wrong here, but it's a charter program, that, but that's correspondence, so it accepts students from all over the state. So the difference, we don't have, as I understand it, we don't have any situations where the students are not correspondents. But we have several, a number of examples of districts enrolling students from across the state in correspondence programs.
I don't understand.
I'm sorry.
Okay, you're saying that LES, successor to Alyeska Central School would fall under this?
Is what? I'm sorry.
They would fall under this? The new centralized education correspondence school would fall under this?
I would say it's an example of what this explicitly says is okay. I think that there is some question. I want to go back one slide. I think there's some question of whether or not it's appropriate for them to, to be operating the way they are. I mean, it could be challenged, and the reason is, as pointed out by the Attorney General, and what Fred pointed out here, one is that everything we're talking about can be done without SB 281. That's stated in that AG opinion. But she also says that the local school district operating within its borders is the foundation of the state education system. Alyeska K-12 is by statutory design delivered locally. So because of that understanding and premise, the number of laws that have gone through subsequently that have stretched that has left it gray. And what SB 281, in my opinion, and what we asked for from the drafters was something that said explicitly what is already allowable, cautiously now, and that is enrollment across district boundaries. In Wasilla, students can bring their children to Anchorage School District and enroll the child in Anchorage, and the only check and balance on that is whether or not Anchorage will agree to take them into the school district. And so the principle and the philosophy doesn't really change with SB 281. It just explicitly points it out.
Okay.
I know that there are several small school districts who their superintendent actually sits in Anchorage. And I know that some of those have done cooperative agreements on purchasing, for instance, and I think some have done that on for building maintenance and renovation. You know, they are just doing some economy of scale sorts of things that this makes is very clear is authorized. Senator Elton.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I think it's a semi-follow-up on Senator Green's question. Wes, I'm going to address the language in Section 2, beginning on line 12, page 1, and going on over to page 2. The way I read this language is, you know, nothing in this section prohibits the expansion of the school district operating area, or, I read this language and I don't see anything that would prohibit, and I'm going to use as an example something that I don't think would happen, that prohibits Juneau from opening a school in Gustavus. It seems to me that this new section is therefore permissive and would allow not just distance delivery, but would allow a brick and mortar school to be opened by one district in another district. And if that is correct, then would the students attending that school be funded at 80% or 100%?
Senator Elton, through the chair, it would be 80% unless the whole district is providing the supervision of the child. And so, you know, that's why there's no incentive for the scenario that you described. That's the way I understand it, is that it's 80% of the funding. The only time you get 100% of the funding is if the home district is providing the non-correspondent portion of what goes on with students, the supervision, the daycare.
If I could follow up, Mr. Chair, if you could go back to the previous slide. I mean, right here it says, the local school district operating within its borders is the foundation of the state's educational system. K-12 is by statutory design delivered locally. It seems to me that if, in fact, a district can open a brick-and-mortar school in another district, whether it's 100% funding, state funding, or 80% state funding, that is in direct contradiction to this statement from the AG's opinion.
That second statement is an interpretation of existing law, as is the first. So, I mean, yeah. If
that's not quoting statute. That's the opinion of the AG.
Right. Here's the statutes here, that the existing statutes that are permissive.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. I understand distance delivery. I understand what Galena is doing and what Alyeska Central School used to do under their original name and is now doing under the new name. But this is a significant change in state policy to allow one district to open a brick and mortar school in another district, and it gives me pause.
Yeah. And it should. As I understand what we're doing here, if a school gets to the fifth year of not making adequate yearly progress, and there are only a couple of limited choices for them, and one of them is that Gustavus, I don't mean that to be pejorative, nor do you, could indeed say to a pretty well-run school district like Juneau, come and help us. And the No Child Left Behind specifically says a change of the structure of the staff, you know, and the administration. So it would allow them to contract with Juneau. But indeed, there would have to be teachers, proctors, whatever, from Gustavus who are there in the classroom, you know, being the classroom monitors and administrating mentors and whatever, and it may even be credentialed people there. You know, it has to be that kind of cooperation. Otherwise, they can only get that would to get to 100% funding. and so on. Now, if the parents in Gustavus did not like what was happening and were discouraged about the local educational establishments able to accomplish it, they could go and deal with your distance delivery system here, you know, and have all their students enrolled in it, and they could be meeting in a common room while they do it, you know, in somebody's home or a church building or even an abandoned school building, and doing it at the 80%.
Mr. Chair, I think I understand that. If there were contractual arrangement between the two districts, there would be 100%. And clearly, the host district would be involved in the decision-making process. And I also understand, I mean, I think you may have described the most benign kind of a situation in which another district could cross borders into another. But, I mean, I don't want to suggest there are predatory districts out there, but it would seem to me that for a relatively minor investment, or perhaps a dollar a year lease, if in fact there were unhappy parents, what you've got is you have got another district operating a brick and mortar school or a wood frame school in another district without a contractual arrangement, and the parents could pick up some of the additional costs, if sure. in fact necessary, and that's a significant change to the philosophy that was expressed here in this statement.
Yeah, and does indeed fit in with No Child Left Behind, a given parents' choice, you know, in schools that are failing, or you know, and so on, which is certainly something we're headed for a collision on, you know, within a couple of years, and so on. I would, any other questions, comments? I would appreciate us moving us on to the next committee, but it is absolutely the will of the committee.
What is the next committee?
It's a little obscure one, finance.
Oh, okay.
Senator Wilkin?
Mr. Chair, I weren't happy to move it out, but I would say at the outset that I appreciate the vision that's in here, but I'm having trouble from a practical standpoint seeing how it works, and so I need a little more help. And with our 53 school districts, we have enough problems trying to track their costs and their activities as much as we can, and this just seems to add a level of complexity that I'm not sure we get the benefit of, and we may not need to be quite this complex quite so soon. And I would just offer for the record that if something like this could move on, that we may want to set up a few districts to try it for some period of time and see if we provide benefit before we open up this box that 10 years from now we're trying to stuff it back in because we've done something here that I'm not so sure if the word manipulate, the word this year is game. So I'm not sure that we're going to game this for whatever reason and not really be able to track it and know exactly what we're doing. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I have moved.
Wait a minute.
Excuse me. Senator Green.
The phrase, the second bullet, cooperative agreement between districts. I still don't see that even in version I.
rather than answer the question, Senator Green, could I suggest that we hold off on this? I mean, we obviously need more work, and I know Senator Dyson, I don't mean to speak for Senator Dyson, but I think we're committed to the long run, and so, you know, the time of the session is such that it'd be best just probably to pull back. So anyway, that's all right.
I'm gonna move the I version, as of our working document, the I version. Or objection to that? Seeing none, right? Senator Elton?
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, I think the suggestion we just heard is a great suggestion. I mean, this is the committee that is going to be looking at the educational issues, and so I think it's a great suggestion. I would love to hear from the Department of Education and get some districts involved in the discussion also. Before.
All right. Thank you. With that in mind, we'll set this aside and go on to the next item of business today, which is a presentation by the American Heart Association on obesity prevention. Who's going to emcee this? Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. For the record, I am Suzanne Minier, and I serve as Director of Advocacy for the American Heart Association, American Stroke Association in Alaska. And, Mr. Chair, I want to thank you very much for the generous amount of time and the attention that you and the committee are giving to what is now an epidemic in our country and in our state. I'd like to introduce the folks that are with me today. At my far right is Dr. Bob Urata. Dr. Urata is a family practice physician here in Juneau. He also is about to assume his role as president of the American Heart Association for the Pacific Mountain Affiliate. To my right is Dr. Rob Boyer, and Dr. Boyer serves as Director of Human Resources for the Anchorage School District. And to my left is Rosie Fletcher, and Rosie, as many of you know, is our Pride of Alaska Olympic athlete, and she is a very active community volunteer with children in schools. She and Dr. Boyer both have served on the Municipality of Anchorage's Task Force on Obesity and Health, and they have just completed a 10-year plan in the Municipality of Anchorage for obesity and health, and want to provide an opportunity for the committee to hear from both Rosie and Rob as the high-level 10-year plan. Before we begin, I want to bring to your attention that I believe you have packets that we've provided for you. The 10-year plan from the Municipality of Anchorage is included on the right, and the PowerPoint presentation is in the left-hand back pocket, as well as some information from CDC on specifics on Alaska's statistics on childhood obesity. And with that, I will turn it over to Dr. Urata.
Thank you very much. I'm Bob Urata, born and raised in Wrangell, Alaska. I've been living in Juneau since 1984, and will be the Pacific Mountain Affiliate's president next year. This is a 10-state affiliate that extends from New Mexico, includes Hawaii, and it goes up to Alaska. We surround California. Obesity has become a focus of our attention because it is now appears to be a rising concern. So I'd like to start out by defining obesity as having a high amount of body fat in relationship to your lean body mass. The measurement that we use is called a body mass index, or BMI, and in adults it's 30 or higher. Please realize that the body mass index does have good correlation with the amount of body fat, but in a person who has who's very muscular, like weightlifters, their soft tissue, which the body mass index reflects, is muscle and not fat. So in somebody who's muscular, it would not be very accurate. In children, we have a different definition. We don't say obesity because of the negative connotations that's associated with it. And the definition for BMI is you are at risk for being overweight if you're between the 85th and 95th percentiles for children or people ages 2 through 20. When you're over a body mass index of over the 95th percentile, then you're considered overweight. The trends show that in the past 20 years, there's been a dramatic increase in obesity in the United States. In 1985, the CDC started doing the behavioral risk factor surveillance system, and only a few states who participated show evidence of obesity. In 2004, this increased dramatically. 9 states had rates of more than 25% obesity, 33 states had rates of 20 to 24%. And so what I'd like to do is scroll through the states, and you can look at the color, because a picture is worth a thousand words. And the first picture here, you can see that Alaska and most of the states have no data. But as we go through this, more states have data, and the light-colored states shows the amount of obesity, which is the most is 10 to 14%. But as we go through the years, and I'll speed up here. Here's 1992. We're starting.
Turn down the light, please. I'm sorry, Senator Olson.
Oh.
Thank you.
As you can see, we're starting to see 15% to 19% prevalence, and as time goes on, more states have that high amount, and now we're starting to see greater than 20% prevalence, and these are the yellow states. We look at Alaska, we hit greater than 20% prevalence in 1998. We do a little bit better in 99, but then in 2000 until the present, we stay up there. And now we see states greater than 25% prevalence in obesity. And so this is becoming a major problem.
Would you go back one, please?
Yes. There's 9 states that have greater than 25% prevalence for obesity.
Wow, and there's only, 3? That's less than 19%?
Yeah. And then you compare this with when this first started in 1985, when we were in the light blue, 10 to 14%, and there were no states 15 to 19%, although the majority of states didn't turn in their questionnaires or weren't doing the risk behavior surveillance program. But now all states do it, and this is one of the things that we're picking up. So we can clearly see the bad trend. In the state of Alaska, 63% of our adults are either overweight or obese. This compares with the United States, where there's only 60% who are overweight or obese. This is in our Alaska high school students. And if you look at the two columns on the right, overweight or at risk for overweight, 29% males and 22% females. And why is this happening? Actually, 8 million children and adolescents are overweight. Over the last 2 decades, the rates for overweight adolescents have tripled. And the media is picking up on this. The consequences for your health if you're overweight or obese is high blood pressure, high cholesterol, orthopedic disorders. Type 2 diabetes is a big thing, psychosocial disorders. And if you're young, you're going to be obese as an adult, or at least be at increased risk. If you're an adult, you have premature mortality. And the example given is if you have a body mass index of over 40, over 45, your life expectancy is cut by over 20 years. And these are people who are over 300 pounds. So you actually lose 20 years of your life. That's a big thing. Other problems, cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, musculoskeletal disorder, sleep apnea, gallbladder disease, and certain types of cancer, including colon cancer, kidney, gallbladder, postmenopausal breast cancer, and endometrial cancer. Cost in Alaska, $195 million in annual direct medical expenses, $17 million financed by Medicare, but for us as a state, $29 million financed by Medicaid. Major financial consequences. So why does this happen? Well, rewarding homework with donuts is one example. Here's some more examples. This is supersizing our meals, fast foods. You'll notice there's no vegetables included in this, no fruits or vegetables, a lot of starch, a lot of carbs. Physical inactivity, this is a terrible thing that's happening in our country. Can't even take the stairs. Walking the dog. I have patients who tell me they get exercise by walking the dog. I'm now going to have to ask them, do they take the car too or not? Or are they actually walking the dog, walking with the dog? And this all leads to Goliath caskets. So this epidemic will soon overtake smoking as the leading preventable cause of death. Obesity has greater morbidity than smoking, problem drinking, and poverty. And to close, the National Institutes of Health projects that our next generation of children will be the first in the history of the United States whose life expectancy is shorter than their parents due to the impacts of obesity and its related health consequences. So I'd like to turn this over to Suzanne.
And, Mr. Chair, I failed to mention that we have two people online as a resource to the committee. Both of them, well, Nathan Johnson with the municipality of Anchorage served as a staff leader to the municipality's task force on obesity and health, and so he is online with us today, as is Tammy Green, who is section chief for the Division of Public Health on Chronic Disease Promotion and Prevention. And Tammy, in addition to serving on the task force and serving in the department, has a master's in public health. Well, the reason that the American Heart Association through policy would recommend that we seek to address this problem with children is that the vast majority of overweight children and adolescents, actually between 70% and 80% of them, will continue to be overweight in adulthood and will be at risk for becoming obese adults. Childhood obesity does predict adult obesity, and public policy is one way to bring about change of the environment. The American Heart Association specifically would seek to address policy changes for quality physical activity and quality nutrition. And the current environment with Alaska adolescents, 82% do not attend physical education classes on a daily basis. 32% are not getting the CDC's recommendation for 60 minutes of physical activity most days of the week. And only 16% of Alaskan children and adolescents are consuming the recommended 5 daily servings of fruits and vegetables. So schools are ideally suited to give adolescents the life skills and support them with adopting daily physical activity and healthy eating behaviors for life. We know that 95% of all children and adolescents are enrolled in school. In the interest of time, I'm going to just jump through these and let you know, and again, the slides are in your packet, that the American Heart Association does have specific principles that we recommend for evaluating quality policy on physical activity and on nutrition. And again, I think in the interest of time, I'd like to mention a poll here and then give you the opportunity to hear from our guests from Anchorage. Last year, Action for Healthy Kids did an opinion survey, and this was very interesting that the second bullet there, 62% of parents rate the child's school as excellent or good on making daily physical education available for all students. That's what parents believe is happening. In reality, only 5.8 to 8% of schools nationally provide students with daily physical education. So parents believe it's happening. In reality, it's not. A couple other polls, parents and teachers are telling us and they're telling us that they want their children to have daily physical activity and physical education in their schools. We know the problem is complex. It's multifaceted, and it's going to require a multifaceted approach. And we'll, as we close here today, we'll mention some things that the American Heart Association is doing outside of policy to work on this issue. At this point, I'd like to turn it to Rosie and have her share a little bit about her passion, why she's been involved in these issues, and her participation with the Municipality of Anchorage's task force.
I learned really quick yesterday that you don't need to get real close to this thing, so I'll save your hearing. As I was introduced, my name is Rosie Fletcher. I have lived in Girdwood my whole life, and for the last 12 years I've had the opportunity to compete in three Olympics and travel around this vast, amazing world. In addition to snowboarding, my passion is working with kids. I feel that they're a demographic that doesn't necessarily have a voice. So in the last 10 years, I've had the opportunity to travel around the state to places such as Anantuvik Pass, Point Hope, Kotzebue Barrow, Matsu Valley, Anchorage School District, and my very own Girdwood Elementary School. In the last 5 years, I've noticed a decline in enthusiasm for nutrition and working out. As a role model, I always like to emphasize the importance of physical activity in addition to nutrition, and I've just noticed that it's definitely taking the back seat to anything technological. For example, Game Boys, Xbox, So it's been a little bit of a concern. That's why I was completely honored to be asked to be a part of the task force. And due to the sensitivity of the issue of obesity, the task force really wanted to emphasize that we weren't against anybody, and that we were for nutrition, for increasing the availability of trails and parks, and for physical nutrition. Excuse me. Before I came here on Monday, I had the opportunity to go to Russian Jack Elementary School. They have an outreach program for both academics and running. And I went on a run with the group. And the group consisted of kids from first grade to sixth grade. And we had one group that was very enthusiastic. They just started sprinting from the word go. We had a group that started sprinting, stopped, picked up leaves, talked to other kids, and then continued sprinting in sort of an interval format. And then what was most concerning was a group of young girls, which I'm guessing were in fourth grade, they hung out towards the back. And so when I noticed that in the beginning, I thought, I'm just going to hang back here and try to get these young girls motivated. So in that process, I said, come on, girls, let's start running. And one of the girls, she was holding a lollipop in her hand. She said, I don't like running. The running's not for me. And I said, how come? You know what? You know, it's great for you, all the benefits. And she said, I don't like to move my legs. And at that point, I was startled because, you know, it's such an overwhelming epidemic. I mean, you've got all these elements, nutrition, physical activity. And at some point, I feel overwhelmed and that my position won't be enough, and which point I was reminded of my position on the task force and that we have come up with a 10-year plan, and I feel confident that it's a step in the right direction. So with that, I'd like to introduce Rob Boyer. He also sits on the task force, and he can explain to you the 10-year plan he came up with.
Thank you, Rosie. Senator Dyson, members of the committee, my name is Rob Boyer. I'm the a director of staffing and recruitment for the Anchorage School District and the district's representative to the mayor's task force. It's my pleasure to be here today to share some of the plan. I've lived in Anchorage for 49 years and I'm proud of the fact that the community has begun the process of looking at this very serious, grave issue. In a variety of ways, the Anchorage School District has their own wellness committee that they've been going through the last 10 months as they get ready to adopt a wellness plan by federal requirement in July. Simultaneously, the mayor's task force has been going on. It started 10 months ago with very solid and varied community involvement. We had restaurant owners, insurance folks, Olympic athletes, Clydesdale runners, and a wide variety of people on the task
force.
Clydesdales, that means we're slower. there were a lot of people on the committee that gave a lot of varied input into these issues. The committee went through a three-pronged approach. We started with our own education, being educated by the experts on the seriousness of the issue as well as the complexity of the issues facing us with this. We then took community input over a large number, both electronically and face-to-face, and then broke up into three different subcommittees as we looked at what we wanted to do out of this task force. The goals and the objectives of the task force that we ended up with in the 10-year plan that you have was to, number one, to somehow ensure that the plan was somehow implemented and that there would be some oversight and review in it. We examined how we can improve the eating habits of the residents of Anchorage, how we can increase the physical activity, and how we could create a community environment that supported a healthy lifestyle. That first goal meant going and having some ways of evaluating the plan progress. And so our plan is broken up into 1, 3, 5, and 10-year goals. And we have a Health and Human Services Committee as well as a committee made up from the Obesity Task Force will be a standing committee that will take a look at the progress we've got with it. In those areas, so they were also looking at ways of putting carrots out there to encourage folks on a community-wide basis to support the plan. The second goal was in the area of nutrition. I was the subcommittee chair for that, and I think my insights into that or observations would be that this is a complex question. This is not a simple question. You know, we can blame it on the vending machines in the schools. We can blame it on all sorts of different things, but the bottom line is a lot of people have their fingers in this pie, whether it's child care or the insurance industry, how we can improve the nutrition at the workplace. I remember one of the committee meetings, as we were talking about vending machines in schools, going down to the workroom in the municipality and looking at the vending machine in the municipal offices, and they were just as bad as those that were in our schools. So it's a very complex issue. Likewise, in the area of physical activity, as Suzanne pointed out, people want to support everyday PE, but everyday PE comes at a cost, both financially from buildings, from staffing issues, from credit issues of whether or not you add additional credit requirements in or take out other additional credit requirements. So we had lots of conversation and came up with recommendations in this area. And finally, we focused on what we called the built environment, what we could do in the Anchorage community to support you know, a more healthy lifestyle. One of my favorite runs that I run when I run slowly is used to be from Eagle River to into Anchorage. It's about a 10-mile run alongside, but round trip, alongside the highway, but it's not plowed during the winter. And so you lose your running place. Just kind of things that we looked at, everything from those type of things to indicating where the stairs are next to elevators. The plan is very comprehensive. It's a good template. It gives us a place to frame the issues and a place for us to start the discussions. The Anchorage School District is actually having a presentation from the Mayor's Task Force, a joint work session in the middle of May, as they look at the advice of that committee and the advice of their own wellness committee in putting forth a wellness plan for the district. With that, I'll turn it back over to Dr. Rada.
Mission of the American Heart Association is to reduce death and disability by 25% by 2010. We are well on our way towards that goal, having reduced heart attacks by around 16% as of 2004. But we see obesity as a barrier to that goal. And so that's why we have taken the task to try to solve this problem. So as policymakers, you're not alone. And we have developed a program in working with other groups. For example, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation has developed an obesity source book, and this is a book that talks about the issue in details, giving out a lot of numbers. We also have an alliance between the American Heart Association and the Clinton Foundation. And we hope that this works out well. Please note that Governor Mike Huckabee is part of this. And so we have Clinton, the Democrat, and Huckabee, the Republican, working on this. And the governor has started working within his state to help develop this plan. The four areas that we're focus are working with the kids, the school, the food industry and restaurant industry, as well as the healthcare program. And our goal is by 2010 halt the increasing prevalence of childhood obesity in the United States, and by the year 2015 reduce the prevalence of childhood obesity by 10%. These are going to be difficult goals to reach, but we have numbers to point for, and we hope that the number of yellow states turns to light blue in the future. Again, I'd like to close with the statement that the National Institutes of Health projects that our next generation of children will be the first in the history of the United States whose life expectancy is shorter than their parents due to the impacts of obesity and its related health consequences. Any questions?
Rob,
what you all are saying, have enough science training to know the difference between cause and effect and correlation. What do the experts think are the major things that have happened in the last 30 years that have caused what you all are calling an epidemic of obesity?
Well, I think
either Rob.
Yeah. There are multiple factors, I think. Decreased activity. Maybe we can blame some of it on computers. You know, kids go home and do their computer games, sit at their computers instead of going out and exercising, playing games or things of that sort. And then I think that fast food diets have changed the dietary habits of what's going, you know, what people eat, with more starches, less vegetables, fruits, and perhaps a lack of knowledge of what's really healthy for you. And we've kind of gotten off that track. So there's multiple things.
I believe from the district standpoint, as we've looked at it, we've examined and are looking where we're culpable. So what have we done with our vending machines, our nutritional programs to add to the problem? And likewise, given the fact that we have many of the students for 7 hours a day, what are the issues that we can do from an educational and physical activity standpoint to readdress it? We certainly still have a high level of extracurricular participation, but it's not with all of our students. The supersizing issues that the doctor spoke to, I think, are significantly there. The committee actually went out and did visits to the schools during lunchtime and watched some of the patterns. And you would see students go and get a healthy lunch and promptly dump the salad and dump the orange and eat the main entree. Or they'd come to school with a huge bag full of goldfish, and that was their lunch. And so there's lots of those issues there. It's complex. I don't think there's one single issue. I think it's a variety of things that have caused it.
And for the sake of our audience, goldfish.
If you have children.
It's kind of like a little cracker.
A little tiny cracker. That are now multicolored, in fact.
So. What, 20, 25 years ago, there was a pretty significant fitness craze, lots of people getting out jogging and lots of other things, and that kind of lifestyle and body type was really seemed to be a goal for lots of folks. Has that shifted?
I'm not so sure that it's shifted. I think that's what a lot of people would like to do. But obesity has kind of crept into the equation, and we now find ourselves not where we want to be. Due to our lifestyles or lack of exercise and some of the foods that we're eating. You know, instead of, you know, you have a bunch of meetings to go to, it's simple to go down to McDonald's and get something to eat, and it fills you up. And then you go back to work or something of that nature. For kids, you know, it's the same thing. It's just like Dr. Boyer said, you know, they don't seem to be motivated to enjoy some of the healthy foods that are necessary to stay healthy, like fruits and vegetables. And it's easy for them to acquire. Go across the street to McDonald's or go to the vending machine, which really makes it easier. So. There are things like that. And then lack of exercise. You know, I want to go to the computer and do my computer games or the Xbox or something of that sort, rather than participate in sports. Or some people might not be able to participate in sports, so they don't do anything.
Senator Wilkin, did you have a question? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam. Mr. Chairman. We've all seen what the negative effects are of obesity. What are the positive effects? And how do you plan on dealing with them, try and avoid essentially some of the bad aspects of being skinny?
Well, I'm not familiar with any positive effects of obesity.
Let me just start drawing them. What about osteoporosis?
Osteoporosis,
yes.
Exercise, a good diet, including calcium, is really important. Exercise stimulates the bones to put more calcium in the bones, and that's extremely helpful. Obesity, you might not see a lot of association with obesity and osteoporosis, but you do see a correlation with obesity and endometrial cancer. So for a woman to be obese,
she might not get osteoporosis, but she could get endometrial cancer because obesity, you know, you get more estrogen effect and consequently abnormal endometrium, and then that leads to cancer. And so I would, you know, if it was my druthers, I'd go for skinny and exercise and good health than obesity and cancer.
With all due respect, Mr. Chairman, I'll take my chance that I'm not, that I'm going to get endometrial cancer.
Yeah.
But let me just go on.
Yeah.
At least my understanding of the journal state that those younger ladies that are into their seventh and eighth decades, if they've been obese, they've got a better chance of having less osteoporosis than those that have been looking like I want to look when I was younger.
Yeah, but their life expectancy will be less if they're obese.
Let's go on to the next question, Mr. Chairman. What about pregnancy? We're dealing with nutrition. Obviously, during pregnancy, you're trying to get the vitamins and those, especially B vitamins that are there for the essentially two people that are there, assuming they just have a singleton in the pregnancy. How do you look at that, the pregnancy issue and the sometimes the lack of nutrition that some of these pregnant young ladies that are.
Well, I think that if you have a good diet and if you take a prenatal vitamin, you should have everything that you need to have a healthy, strong, healthy baby. And that's how the way I counsel my patients. And so far it's worked pretty well. If they're obese, I try to put them on a good, healthy diet and you know, with five vegetables and fruits a day. Lean meats and good balance, three meals a day with a snack, and your prenatal vitamin pill, and that's helped me quite a bit. And if you're obese, sometimes you don't gain a whole lot of weight with pregnancy, but the object is not to lose weight. If you're normal size, then you want to gain about 20 to 30 pounds, and that's how I counsel my patients. And then we put them on the chart and follow the curve. If they follow the curve, great. If they're getting above the curve, you know, then we talk about more detail about what they're eating, if they're going to McDonald's or all that sort of stuff, and how many fruits and vegetables they're eating. If they're doing well, then we just follow it. And sometimes we get have success, and sometimes we don't, but most of the times I think we do. So that's how I deal with it in my practice.
Sir? You mentioned vitamins, and you had another modifying word there. What was that?
Prenatal vitamins.
Okay.
They're vitamins made specially for a pregnancy,
yeah,
to make sure they get enough of the B, which Dr. Olson has alluded to.
And for your obese or overweight patients that are trying to lose weight, do you recommend vitamins?
Yes, but not when they're pregnant. Well, I recommend vitamins when they're pregnant, but I don't recommend they lose weight when they're pregnant.
Yeah, okay.
We don't want them to be in negative.
The overweight, non-pregnant.
Yeah.
What do you recommend for vitamins?
Regular multiple vitamins over the counter, but if they have a balanced diet, they should be fine. And if they exercise, that will help them a lot.
All right.
And, you know, watch, count the calories and the carbs. And the fats, especially the saturated fats and the trans fats.
I know it's Tammy Green's online. Tammy, do you want to add to this discussion?
Oh, yeah, this is Tammy. I don't have anything especially to add at this point, but just in general that we certainly agree with all the things that have been said and know that obesity is really a major issue that we're dealing with. And we're looking forward to working with the committee and our partners in addressing this issue.
Rob.
Dr. Olson, can I make a comment to Dr. Olson? It occurs to me that you were concerned about eating disorders. Is that correct? You were alluding to eating disorders
that's
in the
kind
teenage.
Of what I was headed
yeah.
Towards.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. We don't want to cause eating disorders. Don't get me wrong. Okay. Yeah. So that's a different ball of wax there. So.
All right. So Rosie.
Sorry,
this is my wife sitting over here in the corner, my wife Jane, who has, 15 years ago we had a foster daughter who, and I asked her, and she was 14. I asked her what she was going, if and when she ever got married, what she was going to look for in a husband. And the single preeminent qualification is he had to be a snowboarder.
My kind of girl.
Is that a good value system to evaluate?
I don't know if I should make this come. Sure. Sure, I don't know.
Depends on which one, Mr. Chair.
I see. Yeah. All right. Any other questions or comments for the panel?
Just a comment of thanks for what all four of you are trying to accomplish.
And I have a question. What could we and should we do to help?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, as Tammy mentioned, that the department is looking forward to working with partners and working with committee members. The American Heart Association shares that. As has been said, it's a multifaceted problem, complex problem, and it is going to require a comprehensive, collaborative approach. Tobacco actually comes to mind. A decade ago in the state, you all were faced with some challenges on how are we going to deal with the problem of tobacco, particularly youth consumption, and some very intentional efforts have been made, a comprehensive approach to tobacco prevention and control, and we're seeing the results. We know that tobacco consumption is down 50% in, amongst our youth. We are seeing all-time lows for adult prevalence with smoking, and it strikes me that we will be looking to address the problem of obesity, and particularly childhood obesity, in a very similar fashion, that it's going to take a long time. And I would reference back the slides that I flipped through quickly, which were specific to principles that the American Heart Association supports for quality physical activity and quality nutrition programs. And the American Heart Association stands ready, and I know, as do the partners, our good friends at the Cancer Society, Diabetes Association, and so many others, to begin to address this issue and work with committee members.
So what the legislature did on smoking was at least make it possible for local options on prohibiting smoking in public buildings and so on and so forth. Are you suggesting we should make it illegal to eat in buildings?
No, Mr. Chair, I've actually not come with any specific policy recommendations for today, and I don't know that we'll be heading in that direction, but very happy to work with you and other members of the body to address policy issues as they make sense, particularly during the interim, if we want to need to establish some things and goals for the coming session. We're very eager to move in that direction.
So we also increase the taxes on tobacco products. You want us to put taxes on junk food?
I have not seen that. I'm being told that California has begun to approach that. What I was going to say is that I've not seen evidence that is going at this point is a way to solve our problem. But we have things that we can look to other states and other communities that have seen positive effects with policy change. That's not one that we've looked at.
We at this time of year get pretty jaded about money, and it seems like that's all people talk about. Senator Elton had some legislation that's he offered that would offer a premium of more money to the school districts that threw away their junk food vending machines. I had one that would only allow them to have vending machines if they published the BMI of their faculty and student body, and their junk food machines down the first floor here. And I same bill said that if they were going to stay, the legislature had to publish their legislative BMI. That bill has not gone very far. Well, we really do appreciate what you're doing, and I think all of us are eager to be helpful, and I hope we'd even be good examples. And thank you for what you're doing.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Next, we'll take up House Bill 258.
Could we take an adhesive? I could go to the lounge for a chocolate chip cookie.
We'll take
before you put a dollar tax.
We'll put take a 3-minute break here.
Good to see you. Bye.
Thanks, Rob. Representative Lynn.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, maybe I should have been here for the last presentation as an example of what happens when you get obese. Representative Bob Lynn, District 31, South Anchorage. Chairman and honorable members of the committee, thank you for hearing House Bill 258 this afternoon. This bill makes rape or sexual assault by anyone affected with HIV/AIDS an aggravating factor at sentencing. And that's what this bill is all about and nothing more. The key words here are rape and sexual assault. How or why the perpetrator of rape or sexual assault may have acquired HIV/AIDS is not the issue. And the sexual orientation of the perpetrator is not the issue. And any perceived stigma someone associates with this life-threatening disease is not the issue. Those topics are not the issue. They have nothing whatsoever to do with this bill. This bill is only, and I repeat only, about whether a convicted rapist or sexual predator previously diagnosed with HIV/AIDS should be subject to an aggravating factor as sentencing for their horrific and life-changing crime. I think it should, and I hope you all agree. Not only does the victim of rape and sexual assault suffer the horrific consequences of the attack, the victim must also suffer the effects of a life-threatening HIV/AIDS that could, in effect, be a delayed death sentence. We've received tremendous support from this bill all the way through the process from law enforcement officials and agencies for victims of sexual assault. In fact, Anchorage Police Chief Walt Monaghan described a sexual offender with HIV/AIDS as an assailant with an insidious weapon that can be used to further strike out against victims and victims' loved ones. And Susan Sullivan, Executive Director of Victims of Justice, said, and I hereby quote, adding months of terror and possibly years of illness and a shortened life to the horror of rape, being attacked by an HIV/AIDS positive rapist, a horrendous assault. And finally, Gerald Godfrey, Chairman of the Violent Crimes Compensation Board, urges passage of this bill, and he says, "I, as a sign of respect, compassion, and understanding of the trauma experienced by the victims of serious offenses." And so 24 states throughout the country have laws that specifically criminalize exposure or transmission of HIV/AIDS. And I believe it's time that Alaska joins these other states, considering that this state, unfortunately, has the highest rate of sexual assault and rape in the nation by far. This bill is a proactive measure that acknowledges the additional pain and suffering caused by rapists and sexual assailants who expose their victims to vicious attack and life-threatening diseases, again, which in effect could be a delayed death sentence. We have several witnesses available to answer questions or even testify if you would like to hear them. Need to take the time on it. And they can speak for law enforcement, domestic violence and sexual assault agencies, the Department of Law, and the Department of Corrections. Again, this bill, I feel, is just one more step in making Alaska a safer place to live, work, and play, and I respectfully ask for your support.
The questions are...
And if I may, I'd like to introduce Mr. Mike Seeker. New person in my office is doing a great job, and he's done a lot of work on this bill.
The question, thank you. Welcome. Are there questions for Representative Lynn? Help me, Representative Lynn. This aggravator elevates the sentence for rape or sexual assault from what to what?
It goes, what is it, class?
Susan Parks is here from the department, through the chair. My name is Mike Seeker. Susan Parks is here from the Department of Law to answer that. I think it depends on the sexual assault, if it's under 4 years or over. It's an enhancer. If you'd like to answer that.
Please.
Thank you. For the record, Susan Parks, Deputy Attorney General for the Department of Law, Criminal Division. Mr. Chairman, what this does, there are presumptive ranges, a range of sentences that for sexual assault in the first degree, for example, that a judge can sentence someone to. With an aggravator, it allows the judge, if he or she decides to go above that range and clear up to the maximum, perhaps. So it's simply the finding of an aggravator allows the judge to go beyond the presumptive range that's set for whatever the offense may be.
I see. All right. So it didn't raise it from a C to a B, or it just allows the judge to do that.
Correct. There's discretion then. It does not require an enhanced sentence. It just gives the judge the discretion, and judges can use it to add suspended time, incarceration time, or they can decide that, yes, I find the aggravator, but I don't find that it requires me to enhance the sentence. It's to the discretion of the judge.
Representative Lynn, we've certainly heard testimony here, particularly from our corrections folks, of being assaulted by body fluids being thrown at them or whatever, and with folks who are purport to be HIV positive. Did you consider that that kind of assault?
Mr. Chairman, this is just another bill in the process of making this a safer place to live. On the assault with bodily fluids, this is primary. It could happen. Any of us could be assaulted like that. But and about 99% of these cases are going to be in setting of an institution of some kind. And so that is aimed, you know, mainly at that. This could happen, of course, in an institution. But again, more likely, I think it happened to any of us in the general population. So this is aimed more at the general population, protect any of us. It may not, it would hopefully help prevent any additional pain and suffering caused by the sexual assault, which is bad enough in and of itself. And so while it's part of a public safety package, I think, it's a separate bill.
I think you just said no, and I appreciate that. Yes.
Took me a while.
Through the chair, we have the support also in letters from the Alaska Correctional Officers Association as well as the Public Safety Employees Association. So they also see this as a protection for them as well, although the primary protection are the victims of sexual assault and rape.
All right. Is there anyone here in the audience who wants to testify on this? All right. I have Brenda Stanfill from the Center for Nonviolence. Did you want to speak to us on this bill? Brenda?
I'm just available if you have any questions, but I am in support of this bill.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Lynn, has it in the process that you've gone through here, have there been any people testifying against what you're trying to do here?
Yeah, yes, Mr. Chair. We had one fellow testify. What's the four A's? Anchorage?
Through the chair, it was the Alaska Alliance for AIDS Awareness. His name was Trevor Storrs. He was concerned about the stigma that any bill that mentions HIV or AIDS would cause. He has since not showed up at other committees to oppose it.
And he's been invited to each one.
Yeah, and thank you. And thank you for bringing this forward. Any questions on the committee? Senator Green.
Not a question. I just remember when we had similar legislation to this about 10 years ago. And it was the hottest thing on the block and raised a crowd every time we, and great, great, great discussion and debate and very fiery. This is a very different atmosphere at this time. So,
probably just has to do with the class and quality of the sponsor, right?
Well, I won't say that.
I'll verify.
That sponsor's still around, so.
any other discussion? Chair will entertain a motion on
Mr. Chairman, I'll move House Bill 258 out of committee with individual recommendations and no fiscal notes, I guess.
Is there objection? Seeing none, House Bill 258 passes.
Thank you
for a good job.
Committee. Thank you.
We will now take up HB 393.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Heath Hilliard. I am staff to Representative Tom Anderson, and I will be presenting the bill to you. Prior to my brief presentation, I wanted to note that in your packets there is a blank committee substitute for this committee's consideration that I would just like to point out, the highlight the change for your knowledge.
And that's the L version?
That is correct.
You would like us to adopt that as our working document?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
All right, I'll move that we adopt as our working document the L version, and I'll object and
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I simply wanted to point out the only substantive difference between version L and the previous version can be found on page 2, beginning on line 21. This has to do with the notification requirement for the coverage of the policy. As you know, this bill pertains to mandating coverage for colorectal cancer screening for individuals between the ages of 50 and 65. And there was some contention on the part of several insurance providers about the notification requirement. And Section F clarifies that it's the responsibility of the employer and not the insurance company unless the policy is being purchased directly by an individual from the company, in which case the standard notification process is in place. And that is the only change from the previous version. So I'll just do a very brief presentation. I have also with me Emily Meenan from the American Cancer Society. And in addition, I believe that we have a physician online and perhaps several other people to testify. We also have Ms. Melanie Milhorn from the Division of Retirement and Benefits to talk about the potential impact or lack thereof of this bill on the PERS and TERS insurance coverage system. I just wanted to point out that colorectal cancer is the second leading cause of cancer deaths in Alaska, and Alaska Natives have the highest rates of colorectal cancer in the country. When caught through routine screening at the localized stage, the five-year survival rate for this type of cancer is over 90%. If not caught until advanced stages, the survival rate is only approximately 10%. Colonoscopy is over 90% effective at detecting colon cancer and can remove precancerous polyps. Screening is cost-effective. National studies confirm that the costs of these screenings spread across the insured population is minimal. Covering screenings has also the potential for long-term savings by avoiding treatment costs. With that very brief presentation, I would entertain questions or defer to other individuals that I've noted.
Other questions? Dr. Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you look at some of the colonoscopies that have gone on, what are the incidents of difficulties or complications with colonoscopy? For example, perforation, peritonitis, those kind of issues that certainly can have a negative or cast a negative shadow on the procedure.
Senator Olson, in the process of my preparation for this bill, we haven't looked at that. Or at least I have it. I believe that Emily Neenan from the American Cancer Society could perhaps answer that question, or I believe there's at least one physician online that could probably answer that as well.
Senator Elton.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And Heath, it may be in here, and I may have just missed it. Is there a distinction on what kind of screening? Is it up to the insurer to determine whether or not it's a colonoscopy or I can't remember the technical name for
right.
The other kind of screening?
The original version of the bill specified the four different standards. There were essentially four different examinations, pardon me, through the chair. We chose to take away that language, and what we've done is, and this is on page 2 beginning, section B, line 3, the test specified in the American Cancer Society guidelines for colorectal cancer screening. So what we've done is essentially say that standard will be whatever the ACS standard is. And in discussing this with several of the larger providers, they acknowledged that the ACS standards were, if you will, the gold standard with regard to this type of screening. And so that was a structural decision we made in the other body. So right now it doesn't specify four tests. It says whatever the guidelines are as established by the American Cancer Society. And I believe Emily Neenan would testify, and she probably will, that colonoscopy is probably the most effective, but there are, I think, three other standard examinations.
So just to follow up, so this doesn't give the insurer the right to select from that slate of four. Any one of those four would have to be covered by the provider?
Essentially, I believe that your understanding is correct, if I am understanding you correctly.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair.
Now, Melanie, will you come and join us?
Melanie or Emily? I'm Emily.
I know you are.
With the Cancer Society.
Oh, Mary.
Melanie Milhorn?
Yeah, Melanie Milhorn. No, Melanie, has the administration taken a position on this bill?
Chair Dyson, committee members, thank you. For the record, my name is Melanie Milhorn, and I'm the director for the Division of Retirement and Benefits, and we have not taken a policy position on this particular bill.
And I was told that because we are in essence self-insured, that our statutes that require screenings and tests and so on and so forth like that don't apply to the state. Is that correct?
Yes. Chair Dyson, we have conferred with our Department of Law and also Linda Hall, the director for the Division of Insurance, and we have concluded that our Alaska Care plans, both the active and the retiree plans, are not regulated under Alaska Statute 2142. So then that's the basis for our fiscal note indicating that there is no fiscal impact to our retiree health plans as a result.
Interesting. So on page 2, line 21, when the sponsor's bill here, it says, an employer that provides health care insurance under this section, and so on and so forth, doesn't apply to an employer that's self-insured, or is that an ERISA thing?
We are a government plan, and so we are not bound under ERISA, the state of Alaska plans.
Fascinating. So does, as we have cheerfully put these mandates on the industry over the years, has the state agreed and done it voluntarily, the mandatory insurance provisions that the legislature put on, or have you just cheerfully ignored us?
Chair Dyson, what we have done in the past, the governing authority for the Alaska Care plans is 3930090 for our active plan and our retiree plan, and the authority to make changes to that plan is the Commissioner of Administration. So in the past, there are mandated coverages, which include mammograms, pap smears, and PSA testing, prostate antigen testing, prostate-specific antigen testing. Thank you. The former commissioners have voluntarily place those into our retiree plan. In this particular case, our Commissioner of Administration, Commissioner Nordstrand, would have to make that decision himself.
Interesting. Did you all consider amending the Section 39 as well as 42?
Senator Dyson, at this point in time, we had not made that consideration.
Interesting. All right. Thank you. Senator Elton.
Just a follow-up, Melanie. If they can voluntarily adopt, for example, the prostate screening that had been mandated in previous years, can the existing commissioner voluntarily unadopt, or once it's in the plan, is it considered part of the plan that can't be changed?
Through the chair, Senator Elton, I believe that might be considered a diminishment of benefit. The Alaska Supreme Court has ruled that with regard to the retiree health plan, that your construction and your changes, that the advantages and disadvantages must offset one another.
Thanks.
I would like to add, Chair Dyson, that for the active plan, the colorectal cancer screening is covered so long as it's requested by a provider and it's within 30 days of their annual exam. Preventative screening is not available under the retiree plan for colorectal cancer screening, with the exception if the retiree has a diagnosis, then it would be covered.
I'm trying to figure out what you said just said means. You said the provider. Who's the provider?
Chair Dyson, that would be a physician. If a physician makes a request to have colorectal cancer screening performed for an active employee within 30 days of their annual exam, then it would be covered under the active plan.
Interesting. All right. Any other, Senator Elton?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. A question of Heath, and Melanie may have a comment to make also. Does the requirement imposed in this bill to provide for coverage of colon cancer testing, I'm forgetting, but does that requirement provide that the whole cost of the exam or whatever option you pick off the recipe of tests, or I mean, could it provide that all the insurance company has to do is pay for 15% of the cost or a capped cost? Where does this go
after? To the Chair, Senator Elton, I would point out on page 2, beginning on lines 1 through 2, what it states is the standard policy provisions and the deductible and copayment provisions stay in place. So with regard to additional costs, we had not to this point considered a specific percentage structure, but we did make it clear that all the other standard provisions of the policy remained in place. And so I guess that was our way of addressing and mitigating potential costs to a limited extent.
Okay, so, I mean, I'm going to raise, with the Chair's permission, raise an issue. I just had my annual exam, and my provider recommended a colonoscopy, suggested to me that several of the physicians here in Juneau are going to Seattle to have their colonoscopies done because it's a $5,000 cost here and a $1,500 cost in Seattle. I'm wondering if there are provisions in this bill that suggest that a person might be covered up to $1,500 because that's prevailing standard or prevailing cost someplace else. But it sounds as if that's not addressed in this bill.
Through the Chair, that's correct, Senator Elton. It is not addressed in this bill.
Thanks.
Melanie, my delightful wife, who was here just a bit ago, had this done 18 months ago, and the total bill was over $5,000, and our insurance, state insurance, took care of it. But my wife thought that was outrageous, and has been fighting with them ever since, and has got them beat down to about $2,800, and it's just very irritating to me that we have these providers, you know, apparently taking advantage of the third-party payer, where you know the patient has very little interest in pursuing it, and that's really irritating to me. And she was there 2 hours and 40 minutes. I dropped her off and picked her up, and it was $1,800 or something just for the room. You know, it just seemed outrageous to me, and we got them beat down to $400 or something on that. But what can we and should we be doing to really look at those bills that we get from providers that may be excessive?
Senator Dyson, you raise a very good point, and I think one vehicle that we could use is in our news breaks, the educational process, to talk to our members, both retired members and active members, to make them aware about this screening, and also you know, those kinds of areas is an educational process. And I've talked to Frieda Miller, our health manager, about this particular area, and I think that's where maybe we can make some progress. But with regard to those provider charges, I'm not really sure how to address that, with the exception that your third-party administrator can negotiate charges, and through network savings and those types of things, on an individual basis, you can reduce those particular costs. I think you have to target those costs, and so I think that's another area that we should be looking at.
So you went through your department, and I'm one of your fans, and I appreciate the job you're doing, but it just seems to me that it's pretty difficult to get the state employee and the family to be informed enough to go after that. And it seems to me that somebody, you know, who cares about the state's money ought to be looking at those, as my wife has been, and saying, fully prove to me that this is a legitimate cause, you know, $1,800 for 2 hours of a room. And why aren't we doing that, or what can we do to have somebody hard-nosed and tough like you looking at those invoices?
Senator Dyson, we do look at those particular areas, and Frieda Miller, our health manager, is particularly good at that area. And I'm not going to name the location in Anchorage right now, but we're moving to a different third-party administrator, and we know that there is one monopoly in Anchorage, one provider, and that provider has costs that are, you know, very, very high. And with the next third-party administrator, they haven't negotiated network savings with that particular provider, and so we'll be able to realize those kinds of savings. The other thing that Frieda is talking about doing, which we haven't done right now but we would like to, is to look at those opportunities that Senator Elton raised, to say there are other opportunities. You can go to Seattle. We know that in Anchorage the costs are 40% higher, but offer that, and then change our plan configuration so that we can pay for the air travel, and we're going to move to the travel office in this process as well to try to reduce those air costs. And in doing so, we could, first of all, make our members aware that that option is available, and then use that. I think that that would be beneficial.
Yeah, boy, being in a monopoly situation where you can't compare prices for something like this, which is a relatively standard procedure. Do we have a meeting scheduled for Friday?
Yes.
One of the things when we've gotten into this before, I don't think on our list of testifiers here is anybody representing the insurance industry. Is that correct?
That is correct, sir.
Have you had somebody at previous hearings from the industry?
Senator Dyson, on the first several hearings in the other body, representatives, particularly from Aetna, were present. Mr. Reed Stoops and testified on behalf of that client, and also I believe he represents an insurance industry group, and they testified. They had some concerns with the section that I highlighted that has been changed again, but other than that, they didn't have any opposition to the bill, and as I've been told by representatives of both Aetna and Blue Cross, that they actually already provide for this screening, this coverage, in their standard policies. I believe I added it into your packet today, a note from Mr. Bill Moore, who's the Director of Legislative Policy from Premier Blue Cross, who had said he had reviewed this draft. I did make an attempt to contact both Mr. Stoops and Mr. Reinwand, and was unable to get with them today to have them here to testify, but they have testified in some of the other committees.
So this is a classic dilemma from people on my end of the political spectrum. You know, I really hate putting mandates on the private sector. And if indeed that spending the money on the tests is going to not only provide better health outcomes for the patient, client, and policyholder, but save the insurance company money in the long term, then all of responsible insurance companies ought to be doing it. I remember when we had the prostate screening thing here before us, as I remember it, that's when, what, 5-6 years ago? That we heard the insurance people say, oh no, this is terrible, don't do it. And in my office they said afterwards, it's really a good thing, you know, but we just want you to make everybody do it. Then we're not at a cost disadvantage out there. It is really better for the patients and us. And that's... I guess at my age and experience, I ought not to be surprised, but that was surprising.
Senator, I would point out that there certainly were a number of members in the other body who had similar attitudes and opinions and expressed the same general philosophical approach that you have. We as the sponsor's office have worked very diligently with members from the insurance industry to satisfy any concerns that they have and ensure that this has as minimal an impact as possible, yet still having the benefit from the perspective of public health. And as I said, you know, we have done the homework we can with the insurance companies that have come forward with us. We haven't heard from small private insurers, but the two major insurance companies who provide in this state, we've worked with and are satisfied with the work that we've come up with. So I apologize that they weren't here, but
yeah. And our Linda Hall, our insurance commissioner or director or whatever that she is, what has been her testimony on this issue?
Well, Senator Dyson, her testimony was that from the division's perspective, it had no fiscal impact. With regard to the general policy, she didn't take a position similar to Ms. Milhorn.
All right, Senator Elton.
Thanks. And if I could follow up on an earlier line of questioning from the chair. I mean, you had referenced to the message from Bill Moore, Blue Cross, Blue Shield of Alaska. In part of his message to you and to us, he says, we include the coverage for colorectal cancer screening in all of our plans. Now, is that will still be true if this bill passes, but it will be true even though this does not mandate, assuming Blue Cross takes over for the state. He could still say that even though active and retired state employees would not be covered in that plan unless the commissioner added them, right?
Through the chair, I think I need to correct that, and Ms. Milhorn, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe active people are currently covered with this screening. It's the retirees that are not.
Actives are, I'm sorry, I thought I had understood, actives are only covered if the physician asks for the screening. And this bill would provide that it would be covered whether the physician asked for it or not?
And through the chair, that is correct, Senator Elton.
All right. So we're going to make a decision here pretty quickly. We're off the record. On the record, we will not act on this bill today. We will take it up on Friday. Dr. McClendon in Anchorage, or, can you hear me, sir?
Let me go get him right now if you're ready for him.
All right. Molly McCammon, can you hear me, Molly?
Yes, I can, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Are you in favor of this bill?
I am very much. I am living proof that insurance and screening saves lives.
Including yours?
Including mine.
All right.
Hello?
Yes. Hang on, Molly. Dr. McClendon?
Yes, sir. My name is Darrell McClendon. I'm calling from Anchorage.
Yes, and are you in favor of this bill?
Yes, sir. I'm in favor of this House Bill 393.
Yes.
For colon cancer screening coverage.
Yes.
And the reason I wanted to call in, I know you probably reviewed all the background on how common colon cancer is and how cost-effective colon cancer screening can be. In fact, we can prevent up to 90% of colon cancer deaths if we screen appropriate people. And the cumulative lifetime risk of colon cancer is about 1 in 20, so it's quite common. And unfortunately, most people don't develop symptoms until it's too advanced, and that's why survival rates so low when symptoms develop.
Dr. McClendon, we've had some discussion here. Probably you weren't online, but it appears to be inordinately expensive to do this in Anchorage, and the quality testing is available in other locations. Would you like to comment on that, sir?
I don't know that I'm qualified to comment on the costs, because I don't know what they are outside of the area. And in fact, I can't even quote you my own personal fee schedule, because I haven't looked at that in a while. But I know that it's an invasive test. It requires sedation, monitoring, and there's a facility fee, and there's a professional fee, and if there's any pathology, then there's a fee for that as well. But keep in mind that that's the whole purpose, is to remove these lesions before they turn into cancer. I don't know how the costs compare in our location compared to others.
All right. Thank you.
I've only worked here in Anchorage. I've been in the civilian sector of the Air Force prior to that.
Well, we're glad you chose to stay.
Well, happy to be here.
Good.
And I would like to just give a little anecdote. Just happened this week. I saw a lady for a procedure on Thursday, or on Monday, and I was looking at her paperwork, and she had actually been seen by me back in December. And I said, well, what took you so long to get here? She said, well, I was 64 years old then, and now I'm 65. And she had Medicare coverage. Her insurance didn't cover her for colon cancer screening, as she was asymptomatic. Now, fortunately, she was didn't have any colon cancer diagnosed. But just the week prior to that, I found colon cancer in an asymptomatic person. So it just as well could have been her. And not that 4 months would have made a difference, but had she been 55 and waited until she's 65, she, you know, there could have been a much different outcome. So I think waiting until somebody becomes of Medicare age is probably not wise. And a lot of insurance companies do offer some colon cancer screening, but plans within the plans oftentimes don't. So it's not just one carrier that may offer colon cancer screening benefits to all members. It all depends on each individual plan that's negotiated through the employer.
All right.
In other words, Blue Cross may have a plan with one employer that does cover some screening benefits and another plan that doesn't.
All right. Any questions for Daryl? Yeah, thank you for staying in our state. I hope you stay here a long time.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
Great time. Appreciate the opportunity.
No, appreciate you and your service. All right. Emily, can you join us by, are you going back to Anchorage?
I was planning on it.
Yeah. Can you talk to us by phone on Friday?
Yes, sir.
I assume you're in favor of the bill?
Absolutely.
All right.
And I have a lot more information that I can provide you between now and then about some of the specific questions that have come up.
All right. Appreciate that. And please, I didn't mean to be rude here, but I appreciate all that you all do. All right, and Maria, I assume that you can be back with us on Friday?
No. I just very briefly would want to say that we do support it. We have our letter of support.
Yeah, we saw that.
And so, but Friday, I'm sorry.
All right, well, enjoy yourself. All right, thank you. All right, we're adjourned. Thank you all.